Pitts and Montgomery, Reel 3. Colonel, when you went to Bovington, were you in the same mess as the other tank people?
Yes.
When you mentioned that there was this feeling at first between you, I mean, what sort of thing, how did that...
Well, there was no feeling, not the immediate instructors, it was the odd chap who could be difficult. Not very few, but I do remember one agent who was slightly difficult. I won't go into the question of it. But there was, between the instructors, particularly the NCA instructors, there was very good feeling. I was lucky and had two very good officers who were very nice, and we got on very well. But they told us certain things that had happened previously. Remember, it was 2 years later. And there was just the odd chap who'd been, I suppose, been caught up in that, who could be a bit difficult. And it didn't seem to be, except, as I said, the very happy atmosphere which existed in Egypt. It wasn't quite such a happy atmosphere at Bovington and Lulworth. And nothing to do with the commandants, who were... I can remember one was Colonel Gambier Perry, General Gambier Perry. It couldn't have been nicer. And then I went on a second course once, and there was a Colonel Evans, who was very good. And we had a Colonel Clifton, who commanded one of the tank regiments at Dunkirk, an excellent person. We got on frightfully well with him. But there was just... It was the odd chap, as I suppose one finds in every way. There didn't seem to be an odd chap in Egypt who was difficult, if you know what I mean, because they were all out to help.
You had trouble over leave or something once, didn't you?
Yes, I did, but I don't think I thought that one over. I'm not going to go into that.
What were you training on?
Rolls-Royce, entirely.
Armoured cars.
Rolls-Royce armoured cars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the machine at Bovington and the machine gun at Lulworth.
And how did you get on with that? Did you?
Well, I was never very good mechanically, so that was that. I knew enough to be, just enough to be, not to be bounced into thinking when there was a breakdown. I knew if there wasn't, and theoretically how to deal with it. I probably couldn't deal with it very well myself, but there were the fitters who had to deal with that, or somebody else, one of the driver who knew more. But an incident in the war did bring it up, and a chap said, not one of my own fellows, I was going in a scout car, said that the engine had broken down. And I was very quick, and I damn knew it wasn't. And he was windy and didn't want to go on into the shell fire. So that was, and he went on, so that was all right. I mean, one knew enough about that. But I can't admit that I've ever been keen on mechanics. I'm very keen on the tactical military side and the leadership side and all that. But as long as one knew enough about it, in my opinion, to be able to run the troop and know what was happening, know what was wrong, and when your sergeant came and told you that there was something wrong with this armored car, something wrong with the condenser, or something like that, you knew there was something wrong with the condenser, or you didn't, or you knew it was mechanical, or it was petrol, or something like that. I knew a certain amount about the Rolls-Royce, but I was never mechanical. There's no good pretending it. I was. I enjoyed much more the machine gun, which I knew a bit about.
How did the other officers that were with you from the trial?
Well, they were all very similar. I mean, there was the odd one who was mechanically minded. I mean, quite obviously, the Royal Tank Regiment were much more mechanically minded than the cavalry. That was the difference. Tactically minded, cavalry were very, very tactically minded. And... obviously, the Royal Tank Regiment knew far more about the inside of any vehicle than we ever did, with exceptions.
You said there that the cavalry were more tactically minded than the tank.
No, I didn't say they were more tactically minded than the tank, but they were very tactically minded. No, I wouldn't say that, but I mean, I just said that was their strong point. And... mind you, they appreciated the mechanical side because the thing had to jolly well work. I mean, I always remember General McCrary sending for me, he was colonel before the war, And I was sent as adjutant to the County of London Yeomanry. And he said to me, I'm going to send you on a course to Bovington. He always thought, I'd send you on a course to Bovington again. But I said, but I'm qualified, sir. And I think I know much about the inside of an armoured car as you do, Colonel. In that case, you damn well go, because I don't know much and I'm going on a course too. So I went, and I qualified as an instructor. I don't think one had to know enough about the inside of a vehicle at that stage to be able to see that one's, certainly in theory, that the NCOs were up to the standard of being able to teach the yeomanry their vehicles.
When you shifted over to the gunnery at Lulworth,
yeah.
You were happier in that, were you? That was...
Well, I don't know. I liked it. I happened to like Lulworth as a place more. And I liked the... I found, funnily enough, a little more difficulties at Lulworth, what I had talked about previously, at Lulworth more than I did at Bovington. But I was on something I knew more about, I liked more, and it's always a question of if you liked more than I did at Bovington.
Did you find it different? I mean, what differences were there between the training there and the training you'd had on guns previously?
Not very much, but you're much more sophisticated, you see. I mean, one was only taught on machine gun. I remember being taught by Sergeant Arnold of the Royal Tank Regiment for about a fortnight. Because I was still, remember, a two-pleater at Horses. For about a fortnight, I had a short, very short course on the machine gun and the basic principles. And of course, one knew the whole thing and stripped the whole gun down and knew all about it.
Had your experience in Palestine helped when you went to Bovington, do you think, at all?
I think that always helped. It had certainly improved one's... I don't say the mechanical knowledge and the machine gun knowledge, no, possibly, but it was an experience for a young officer, a very good one. Very different.
When you went back to Egypt, what sort of state did you find the squadron in terms of training?
Well, because, it took time. We went back and I suppose they just got their vehicles. I mean, we were on the elementary side, but we got to it pretty quick. Of course, I think probably by that time, I can't remember, we got one or two NCOs transferred who'd been previously mechanized. I remember I had a new troop sergeant, Sergeant Pole, who was absolutely first class, and he went as an instructor to Bovington for years. He was a warrant officer of Class 1, I think, in the end. But, I mean, he was a very, very good indeed. And he was my troop sergeant, and what he didn't know about the mechanics, he was absolutely excellent. But he was one of the young chaps who'd been trained, and he came from the armoured car squadron, and I happened to luckily have him as my troop sergeant. He was very good indeed.
What was your daily routine then? Now that you got all the armoured cars by the time you came back, had
you?
Yeah.
One had maintenance and one had exactly the same as in the cavalry. From the point of view, one had individual training, one had troop training, squadron training, regimental training, gate exercises and manoeuvres. Exactly the same system of training. Of course, with the armoured cars as opposed to the horse.
But wouldn't it change a lot now that you had a car, armoured car instead of a horse?
Oh, the training was completely different. Yeah. Entirely different, but it was the same system. Yeah. Exactly the same system, and I think the Royal Tank Regiment had exactly... I think the British Army had pretty well had the same system. As far as I remember, the infantry had the same. We all had the same... the whole British Army had the same system. So that one finished up at the top with manoeuvres.
What was this individual training that went on?
Oh, that was the training in machine guns, limited signals, tactics, driving and maintenance. And remember, you had Rolls-Royce, you had Leyland's transport, you had Austin 7s, and you had various different types of vehicles. And one's the revolver and the rifle. Of course, later on, presumably the Royal Tank Regiment, the two-pounder. When that was during the war that I went to the Yeomanry, had tanks, and one had a two-pounder, was a very essential thing. And, of course, a lot of this limited amount of wireless training, which, in my opinion, was terribly important, particularly for an armoured car regiment.
The tactics that you said, what were you actually training in tactics? What kind of things were you doing?
Reconnaissance, sort of fighting to a limited extent. Remember that you hadn't got any things like two-pounders and that sort of, as I said, one could presumably attack with an armoured car. I mean, he never came to that with us. And internal security, particularly for Egypt. That was the internal security of the country. And as I say, you did it by troops, then you had to do it by squadrons, which you all getting up, then you did it regimentally.
In this reconnaissance rail, was there differences now that you've got armoured cars?
No, in principle, no, except you went farther afield, of course, much farther afield.
How would you go about that? You went off somewhere, did you?
Oh, yes. I remember Colonel Hornby. I'll come into the question of commanding officers. We were extremely lucky in Trouble of Loss. I had brilliant ones. We started off with General Blaxton Houston, who, as I say, did the first 6 months, just got us. Then we had Colonel Charrington, who became a brigadier on the war, who was very sound technically. Then we had old Colonel Hornby, who was a tremendous character, spent most of his life in Sudan. But he's a wonderful trainer of men, extraordinarily good trainer. Not a great man, no staff college sergeant, but a splendid chap. Then, of course, we had Colonel McCrary, General McCrary, who was outstanding. And then Colonel Lumsden, who was outstanding. So that one had these wonderful commanding officers, which is one after the other, which is a tremendous boon.
You mentioned, for example, Colonel Hornby, that he was a good trainer of men. What do you mean quite by that?
He got the art of being able to get the right attitude as regards training. He was very, very sound technically himself. And we always seemed to come out frightfully well on any training exercises. And he was a leader, which is so very important. He got no great brain, but he was a leader, and people admired him, and most people who were any good liked him. And the sort of things he did was to send off troops. I was sent off. You wanted to hear this one, didn't you? I was sent off. The squadron was sent from Cairo to Wadi Halfa, and at Assiut I was sent off to find a lone palm halfway between French Equatorial Africa and in the Sudan, French Equatorial Africa border and the Sudanese border, which and then come in to rejoin the squadron at Wadi Halfa. In this particular exercise, I had an armoured car, an Austin 7, a Leyland 3 Terrier wireless lorry, and two 3-tonners, and I think a small staff car rolled, and it was about a 500-mile trek, and nobody had been to Lone Palm for about 2 years, and of course I got things from the LRDG, well they weren't LRDG, from the explorers, and we were sent off to find this by compass, and I had to give him the absolute detailed, Colonel Hornby, the detailed administration of how much petrol, how much oil, and also how much water I took and rations. And he went through it like a sieve and cut down my water supply and said I could dig. We did dig. The water was perfectly appalling. It was brackish. And we all arrived with put it vocally with the squitters. But we found it. It's a marvellous training for two pleaders. And I always remember Sir Andrew Horsburgh Porter, who I think you're probably going to see. I was talking to him on the telephone just last night, in fact. He was sent to find a way through the Sinai. Not the two well-known routes, no route at all. In fact, the route he was told to take, I don't think he ever got through there, anyway. But he also had this same setup as I did, roughly. And he was only about 100 miles from Cairo, and I was 1,000 miles. And for some unknown reason, he could not get Cairo with his wireless. But he could get me 1,000 miles away in Sudan, and I used to have to relay the messages backwards and forwards between regimental headquarters and Cairo. And I was going along outside. But it was some sort of particular jump in the wireless set that happened in that particular thing inside. It just didn't work at that distance. And yet it was working 1,000 miles absolutely perfectly. But it was, we all were sent in. I remember Major War was in the second attempt. He was sent out to the Western Desert. He did the first-class troop training, which is fit for good for young officers.
When you went off like that, how many, in fact, would you be?
Well, we were three in an armoured car. I had an extra officer, Neil Austin. I suppose we were about 15 strong, I can't remember. I remember Sergeant Alborough was my troop sergeant. And we'd be 2 or 3 tunners, there'd be a crew of two, or certainly two, if not possibly three. I think it was, I can't remember all fair, I think about 15 of them. Might have been, one didn't have one whole troop, but one had all the best of them, which was a very good thing. Obviously, fellows who were going to be future NCOs and things like that.
Quite a lot of the tactics then, reconnaissance and things, were things where you were using armoured cars far more effectively than horses, would you say?
Well, oh yes, because one was going farther afield. I mean, one couldn't possibly have done that with horses.
So that there had been this complete acceptance of the mechanised rail?
Oh, in complete, from our point of view, complete acceptance. I mean, we still used to like our horses to go out hunting. We played polo, and then we won the regimental polo. We were still a good, from a private side, from the sporting side, we were still a good regiment, and we held our own and more than our own in that field, from the officer's point of view. And, you know, one or two of the senior NCOs still, not many, but rode. But otherwise, I mean, that was nothing to do with our actual training. Although the training on the horse, I think, was extremely good to the development of the particularly the armoured car. And then, when having been armoured car, one could adapt oneself to the tanks. I had to do that during the beginning of the war, because I was in tanks for fighting for 9 months, the Cairo Line in Yemen. And it wasn't all that difficult to adapt oneself. But I think the horse, one of the great things about the horse, it gave one a tremendous eye for country. An eye for country can help like hell during wartime, or even in peacetime, because one can see things and how to get to a place very much better than those who haven't got an eye for country or had the chance of getting an eye for country. But even in the infantry role, I think, certainly the Royal Tank role would be the same, but the infantry role, I think an eye for country is a great help.
Would you say that's one of the main advantages of training on a horse for going?
Well, I mean, training on a horse, from the point of view of armoured cars and mechanisation, yes. But you must remember that the training on the horse was for a different type of warfare, really. I mean, I don't think the cavalry, of course, in Palestine, they had a tremendous role to play in the First World War, in Mesopotamia and places. But in France, they didn't, except at the beginning and except at the end. And I think they were probably, with the advance of mechanisation, it was quite obvious that they were coming to an end from that point of view.
in your tactical exercises, did you make allowance for working with tanks?
Well, we didn't have much chance of working with tanks, really, because there were so few. Remember, there were so few tank regiments, and they were working an awful lot with the infantry in those days because they were so slow. And it was only, oh, I should have thought, and I'm talking out of context a little bit, about the sort of 37, middle 30 period that it began to be appreciated.
But as far as you're concerned, in these exercises you were doing out in the desert, you didn't really take into account tanks much.
Well, I can't remember. We couldn't have done, because I don't think we had much. We may have been right at the end. We hadn't got many tanks in Egypt. We had we took over their role of the armoured cars. And I suppose that they felt, they must have felt rather put about in a way. They lost that, except for this company in India. One's got to remember that. And we took over their role in Egypt. And of course, they had, I think I'm right in saying, there were no tanks in Egypt until about the 30s. Certainly when we were there, I'm sure there weren't. And they had these two armoured car companies, and we took over their role, you see.
Did the officers that were from the RTC who came over to help, you know, in that training time, did they express any sort of feeling about that you've taken over their job?
I don't think so, because, you see, it was rather subaltern to subaltern. And I can't remember anything like that. And I don't think it would have happened with those particular chaps. One or two may have done, who we didn't know so well. But I can't remember.
When you went from then troop training to regimental training...
Well, squadron training.
Squadron training, yes. What did that consist of?
Oh, the same thing, but in a broader front you had four troops, you see. And the four troops had to operate together on a much wider front. A troop training, you just, with formations and that sort of thing, and how you approached and all that sort of business. And then, of course, one had, one also had battle runs and with the armour and all that sort of thing.
What does that mean?
Well, that was, I mean, that was a field firing, it was they called in those days, as far as I remember. And, I mean, you had various targets used to come up with your armoured cars, and you had to engage these targets. You went from A to B and B to C. You had a battle run, and a target come up, and you had to swing round and engage it. I mean, firing live ammunition.
Out in the desert?
Out in the desert, yes, but at specific points. Because, I mean, even then you might get odd people wandering about, and of course one had to have DRs and things out in case the old native came along with his camel, like that in the middle of the rain. That did happen on occasion.
excuse me. When you did that sort of thing, were you working with other arms as well? As an infantry?
No, that was entirely... one couldn't... there was no place where one could do that at that stage.
What kind of gunnery training were you doing out there? In
machine guns.
Yeah.
You see, that was what we were armed with. We had nothing else. And it wasn't until later on, until the late 30s, that one had the big Beezer and little Beezer. And it wasn't until the war... Well on in the war that one had the two-pounder. I remember as Commander of the 12th, the Daimler was the first two-pounder I had.
Were you training to actually be firing while you were moving, or did you actually stop to fire?
Both. Both. Because one wanted to have accurate firing on the move. But no, both. Most, one had two, and then one had the ranges too, which was firing statically. And then one had one's rifles and that sort of thing, and competitions and things like that.
What sort of standard would you say the gunnery was?
Oh, it was pretty good. I mean, of course it got better and better as time went on. But one of the things which was, I always complained about was the, and in tanks and kind of, the little bees are blocked quite very easily in the desert. We had an awful lot of stoppages, and it always seemed to be at the moment you wanted to use the damn thing, anything stopped. 2 pounders were reliable.
Did you have any experience, direct experience of this stoppage? Did you?
What?
You actually had experience of being in.
Oh, I'm continually having experience of stoppages, of getting dirt into the Beezer. And the Hotchkiss gun was the worst. We had a Hotchkiss gun, that's when we were mounted. Then we went, and the Lewis gun was, got a bit. The machine gun was much the most reliable, funnily enough. And were more reliable than the Beezer. The big Beezer didn't get so much stoppages. I had very little to do with that. I had a big Beezer on my own Humber when I was commanding, but I practically rarely used it. But the little Beezer, particularly in the with the Crusader tank, was a damn. It wasn't a nuisance. One wanted it at times, and it always seemed to go half a belt, and then there'd be a stoppage, and just at the moment one wanted it. And caused practically entirely through sand, of course, in the desert. Whether they had a stoppages in mud. When they went to Normandy, I don't know, because I wasn't there.
You mentioned sand there. How did this affect the armoured cars? Did you have trouble with armoured cars in the desert?
Oh, yes. Well, with the rails, one always carried an enormous long pole to put in between the twin towers at the back to get, and sand mats. And one was continually digging. One got jolly good at that. Particularly, I can remember the worst digging I had naturally was on that route from Assio to the Lone Palm and back to Wadi Halfa. And one day I remember we only did about 8 or 9 miles the whole day. We were digging. That was an exception. But we had a hell of a lot of digging to do. Well, an unknown route. One could